Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Dan Novak, Dan Friedel, and Katie Weaver. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
In April, Twitter accepted American billionaire Elon Musk's offer to buy the social media service for $44 billion. But earlier this month, Musk withdrew his offer. Twitter reacted by bringing a legal case against Musk to force him to buy the company. Legal experts say Twitter wants to complete the deal that both sides agreed to. The company said Musk's reasons for backing out are just a cover for changing his mind. In April, Musk offered to pay $54.20 a share for Twitter. The company accepted the offer after opposing the sale earlier. Musk accused Twitter of not giving him enough information about how many spam accounts appear on the service. But Twitter argues that Musk is refusing to honor his obligations to Twitter and its stockholders because the deal he signed no longer serves his personal interests. Musk agreed to pay 38% above Twitter's stock price at the time he offered a take-it-or-leave-it deal, the legal case states. But soon after, the stock market suffered a big drop. Many stocks lost value. This led to shares of electric car maker Tesla, which Musk owns, to lose more than $100 billion in value. Most of Musk's personal wealth comes from his holdings of Tesla stock. If the two sides do not reach a settlement out of court, the case will go to trial and a judge could start making decisions this summer. Twitter has told its employees it asked for an expedited trial to be heard in September. The company said it is critically important to get the case tried quickly. But experts say a trial could last weeks or longer. Twitter would probably want to get things done fast. Elon, I don't know, Lawrence Cunningham told the Associated Press. He is a law professor and corporate legal expert at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Musk reacted officially to Twitter's legal case or lawsuit on Friday. His lawyers gave a written request to the court hearing the case in the northeastern state of Delaware. In the request, Musk again accused Twitter of keeping spam account data from him. The document also disputed Twitter's request for an expedited trial. Musk's lawyers said it would take months to gather information from Twitter on the spam account issue and to identify and speak to witnesses. The document also repeated several other accusations Musk has made in the past. They include a claim that Twitter violated terms of the deal when it dismissed two high-level company officials without first informing Musk. The spam account question will likely be a central part of the case. That is the main reason Musk gave for backing out of or withdrawing from the deal. Twitter claims in its lawsuit that Musk started saying he wanted to buy Twitter to remove crypto spam. Musk said he considered it a major blight on the user experience. But Twitter claims that when the stock market dropped, Musk shifted his narrative. The company said the billionaire then demanded proof that spam was not a serious problem on the service. The court will examine whether the spam issue presents a material breach of Twitter's obligation in the deal, as Musk claims. On the other hand, it will look at whether Musk violated his obligation to follow through with the contract that he signed. I'm Brian Lynn.
Sri Lanka's acting president, Ranil Wickremesinghe, said on Monday that the country had almost completed bailout talks with international lenders. The acting president further explained that negotiations with the International Monetary Fund were nearing conclusion, and discussions for assistance with foreign countries were also progressing, Wickremesinghe's office said in a statement. Late Sunday, Wickremesinghe declared a state of emergency as Sri Lanka continues to face a deep economic crisis. The move aims to calm unrest ahead of a vote in Parliament later this week to elect a new president. Sri Lanka is seeking a financial rescue plan from the IMF and other organizations, but top officials say the country's finances are so poor that even getting a bailout has been difficult. There has been no comment from the IMF on Wickremesinghe's statement. The acting president said that aid was being provided to people and steps taken to ease shortages of fuel and cooking gas. However, he said elements within society were causing unrest. He said disorder will not be permitted to harm the country's progress. Wickremesinghe said that peaceful protesters who had real concerns would be heard by the government. He urged political parties to put aside their differences and form an all-party government which would permit the country to recover from the economic crisis. Sri Lanka's leaders have declared a state of emergency several times since April. That was when protests started against the government's reaction to the economic crisis and shortage of necessary goods. Earlier emergency declarations have permitted the military to arrest and detain people, search private property, and end public protests. Last week, hundreds of thousands of anti-government protesters came out onto the streets of Colombo and occupied President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's official home and office. He later fled to the Maldives Islands and then to Singapore. Parliament accepted Rajapaksa's resignation on Friday. It met a day later to begin the process of electing a new president. A vote is expected Wednesday. I'm Dan Novak.
African nations along the coast of the Indian Ocean hope they can borrow money for rebuilding and conservation efforts. They are planning to offer what they are calling blue bonds to companies and investors. A bond is a lending agreement in which the borrower agrees to pay back the money with interest. The United Nations says the money is needed because many wealthy nations have not followed through on promises to pay for projects to fight the effects of climate change. some of Africa's eastern nations hope that private investment will pay for projects that could help boost the economies of coastal communities, protect the environment, and prepare for bad weather and other effects of climate change. The project is being called the Great Blue Wall. It is similar to another idea, Africa's Great Green Wall plan. The Green Wall project is supposed to help create a barrier of trees and agricultural areas that will protect soil and keep the Sahara Desert from expanding. The Green Wall plan stretches from east to west Africa along the southern edge of the Sahara Desert. Discussions about the Great Blue Wall came as the UN held a forum on sustainable development from July 5th to 15th in New York City. The bond plan means that people who invest in financial markets can help pay for the projects. If the bonds are successful, the investors will make a profit. Jorge Familiar is vice president of the World Bank. He called blue bonds a powerful example of the critical role that the capital markets can play in supporting sustainable objectives. The Great Blue Wall plan started last year during the UN's Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, Scotland. The goal is to create protected areas along the coast of 10 Western Indian Ocean nations. Supporters of the plan hope it will restore and conserve millions of hectares of ocean, capture 100 million tons of carbon dioxide, and help 70 million people get regular work. The project goes from Somalia in the north to South Africa. It also includes island states like Madagascar and the Seychelles. Jean-Paul Adam is the head of the climate division at the UN's Economic Commission for Africa. He said the plan will recognize the value of the environment in future wealth creation and empowerment of local communities. Adam said right now, less than 1% of blue and green bonds are issued for projects in African nations. He said, African nations need to be able to offer more bonds in financial markets, calling it a next step. The African Development Bank, ADM, said much more money is needed for countries to reach international climate goals. The bank said an investment of between $1.3 and $1.6 trillion is needed by 2030. The ADM said currently, blue bonds only make up a small percentage of ocean conservation money. The bonds will not be a full solution for the lack of financing, Adam said, but they can allow us to raise large amounts. I'm Dan Friedel.
If you live in an area of temperate climate and enjoy homegrown vegetables, it is time to start planting now. A temperate climate area is a part of the earth that lies between 40 to 60 degrees north or south of the equator. Gardening expert Jessica Damiano writes for the Associated Press. She says if you live in a temperate area, start planting cool weather crops now, and you will enjoy the fruits of your labor by November. The process for starting seeds and planting starter plants is the same year-round. But when planting crops for autumn in areas that experience frosts and freezes, timing needs to be exact. If you plant cool weather crops too early, they might not grow well under the summer sun. If you are too late, the cold weather could kill them before they are fully grown. To get it right, you will need to know the average date of the first frost in your area. That is the time when the ground will harden and ice will form overnight. Next, count backward from your first frost date by the number of days the individual crops will be fully grown, and use that target date as a starting point. There are some exceptions. In the southernmost temperate areas, for example, you can still plant summer vegetables like tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, squash, and beans in August and September. But cool weather crops should wait until October or November. Greens like arugula, Asian greens, collards, kale, lettuces, mustard greens, spinach, and Swiss chard, and root crops like beets, radishes, and parsnips grow well in the cool temperatures and limited daylight of the autumn season. Their seeds can be put directly into the garden or outdoor containers in most areas. But it is better to start these seeds indoors with cooler temperatures over hot summer weather. Work with the soil before seeding or transplanting. Add generous amounts of organic matter like compost or aged manure to garden soil. Mix in a slow-release fertilizer also. If you are planting root crops, loosen the soil 25 to 30 centimeters deep to ease their growth downward. Plant the seeds at the depth of about twice their width. Space them out to avoid overcrowding. Keep the soil wet, but be careful to avoid washing away seeds. And firmly but gently pack the soil into place. If seeds are tiny, you can spread them over the soil and then remove extra growths to avoid crowding out the plants. After the seeds develop, apply mulch to retain water in the soil to keep the temperature even. This can also block undesirable plants called weeds from taking over the area. Pull up any weeds that you find, as they take water and nutrients that your crop needs. Keep plants well watered during the remaining summer months to protect them from heat damage. As cold weather arrives, do not worry that your crops will die under a frost. Crops like Brussels sprouts, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, collards, kale, and kohlrabi are improved by a light frost. A light frost is an overnight temperature of 0 degrees Celsius. Artichokes, arugula, beets, carrots, cauliflower, celery, endive, escarole, lettuce, parsnips, radicchio, Swiss chard, and many Asian greens can survive a hard frost at -2 degrees Celsius for a limited time. And you can always protect crops from overnight frost by covering them with cloth material and plastics. But remember to remove all coverings in the morning. Your plants need the day's sunlight to grow into delicious and healthful food. I'm Katie Weaver.
VOA Learning English presents
America's Presidents. Today we are talking about a vice president. John Tyler was William Henry Harrison's partner on the ticket in the 1840 election. He was the Tyler of the campaign slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. But only 1 month into his term as president, Harrison unexpectedly died. He was the first U.S. president to die in office. Today, Americans accept that when that happens, the vice president becomes the president. But in 1841, no one really knew what to do. So people turned to the Constitution. It said, if the president is removed from office, or if he dies, resigns, or is not able to perform his duties, his power and responsibility is given to the vice president. But the meaning of those words was unclear. Did the vice president really become the president? Or did the vice president just act like the president? The Constitution may not have been clear, but John Tyler was. He claimed that after Harrison's death, he really was the president. Tyler made sure he was quickly sworn in. He answered only to the title president. He even refused to open letters that were sent to acting President Tyler. Eventually, Americans accepted John Tyler was the nation's 10th president. But some Americans were not happy about that fact. During his presidency, all but one of Tyler's cabinet advisors resigned, and members of his own party tried to impeach him. Tyler was from the southern state of Virginia, home to five earlier U.S. presidents. Like many of the leaders before him, he was a lawyer from an upper-class family who owned slaves. He strongly supported the power of the states against the federal government, expansion of slavery, and rule by a small, elite group. But the United States was starting to change. For example, President John Quincy Adams had proposed creating a national system of roads. The Missouri Compromise of 1820 limited slavery in new states in the Northwest. And in the 1830s, many white men who did not own property earned the right to vote. In other words, the U.S. was becoming more national, abolitionist, and equal. Tyler resisted these changes. He fought against them as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, a governor of Virginia, and a senator. His fight reached a crisis during the presidency of Andrew Jackson. The two men belonged to the same party, the Democratic Party. However, Tyler hated Jackson's populist policies and use of presidential powers against the states. In the middle of the 1830s, Tyler joined with several other political leaders to create a new anti-Jackson party. They were called the Whigs. The new Whig Party badly wanted to win the 1840 presidential election against Jackson's right-hand man, Martin Van Buren. They proposed John Tyler as the party's vice presidential candidate because they hoped he would appeal to Southern voters. the Whigs succeeded. Tyler and Harrison won the election. The new party expected that they would be able to achieve many of their policy goals. But then Harrison died, and Tyler unexpectedly became president. Tyler kept Harrison's cabinet of top advisors, but he did not accept their advice. Whig lawmakers presented bill after bill to Tyler, but he failed to support the measures. He believed they gave too much power to the federal government over the states. In anger, all but one of Tyler's cabinet members resigned. Then Whig leaders officially declared that Tyler was no longer part of their group. The following year, they even moved to impeach him. He became known as a president without a party. Tyler was able to achieve one major political act, however. 3 days before he left office, he signed the law that made Texas a state. Perhaps wisely, Tyler withdrew from the next presidential election. He eventually withdrew even his support for the federal government. He became a leader in the movement for Southern secession. In other words, he believed the Southern states had the right to separate from the North and leave the Union. In time, the separation between the South and North would lead to the Civil War. Tyler was an unusual president. He took office in an unusual way, and he took the unusual step of vetoing legislative action proposed by his own party. His family life has other unusual details. Tyler was the first president to get married while in office. He was the president with the most children, and two of his grandchildren remained alive until well into the 21st century. In 1844, Tyler married Julia Gardner. She was his second wife. His first wife, Letitia, had died 2 years earlier. John and Letitia Tyler had 8 children together. Since Julia Gardner Tyler was 24 years old, 30 years younger than her new husband, the two had plenty of time to have another 7 children. And because one of their sons had children in the 1920s, 2 of Tyler's grandchildren are still alive as of early 2017. Tyler is not remembered as a good president, but he is remembered for establishing a precedent, a way of doing something that other people have followed. The Tyler precedent permitted the peaceful transfer of power from president to vice president in 1841, and it eased the transition after other presidents have died since then. In 1967, the Constitution was even changed to clarify what Tyler had claimed all along. When the president dies, the vice president becomes the new chief executive. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.